So, besides the writing of William Burroughs, where have the ideas of Korzybski found their way into literature?
I suppose there must be some influence on Ginsberg because he was so heavily influenced by Burroughs. To me, though, the equivalent of Korzybski in literature is Joyce's Ulysses, which has lots of is's in it. And because the narrative voice keeps changing throughout the book, you gradually begin to realize you can't trust any one reality tunnel. Everybody is perceiving a different day in Dublin on that particular day. That day when, as Edna O'Brien wrote, nothing and everything is happening.
Now, you hold a particular reverence almost for Joyce, it seems. What is it about Joyce that you find so fascinating?
There are many, many things, but I suppose the principal thing that comes to mind is inexhaustibility. If I like a book a lot, I tend to read it a second time and sometimes a third time. Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, I never stop reading. I'm continually rereading them or picking them up and reading a couple of pages or reading a chapter. I got Ulysses on videotape. It was a 30-hour reading done by some of the best actors in Ireland, done on RTE in 1982. And I recorded it on videotape so you don't have to change the tape so often. You can get 6 hours on a videotape. And I got the whole 30 hours. Every now and then I play some of that. Instead of reading the text, I just lie back and listen to the music of the words.
Is that an unabridged reading?
Yeah, it's a total. They read the whole goddamn text from Stately Plump Buck Mulligan right up to Yes, I Will, Yes. The whole damn text. And they had some fantastic actors. Best actors in Ireland. And they all changed their intonations as the styles changed, too.
So it's his inexhaustibility in the sense that he creates a world?
Yeah, I will talk about Finnegan's Wake later maybe, but that one day in Dublin, June 16, 1904, everything is happening. It's a very ordinary day, to quote Edna O'Brien again, a day when nothing and everything is happening. But in that day, Bloom goes to a funeral. And he goes to a maternity hospital to visit a woman friend who's in labor. So you have birth and death. He visits a whorehouse and he visits a church. He visits a newspaper office where they're all quoting outstandingly hilarious examples of pompous political speeches. And he passes through the library where they're all discussing Shakespeare. Everything is going on at once in Ulysses, every aspect of human life. Bloom defecates in chapter 4, masturbates in chapter 12, and urinates in chapter 17. You know, everything that happens in an ordinary day.
And according to Joyce's own descriptions, what was he trying to do with this text?
Well, Joyce was not much given to explaining himself. He dropped hints. It seems to me one of Joyce's major motives consisted of trying to push realism to the point where it refutes itself. He'd read and been very heavily influenced by a lot of naturalistic writers, Zola, Thomas Hardy, and especially the plays of Henrik Ibsen. Ibsen, of course, gradually moved from naturalism to expressionism as his career went on. But Joyce felt that if he pushed realism far enough, it would collapse upon itself. The closest you can get to realism, it seems, in literature, is the style Joyce uses in most of Ulysses, which is the interior monologue. You're inside one person's head, and you perceive that person perceives it. Then you jump to somebody else's head, the style changes, and you're perceiving the same day from an entirely different perspective. So the closer you get to realism, the more you realize there is no reality. There are realities, plural. Or reality tunnels, to quote Timothy Leary. Leary, by the way, said Joyce's prose prepared, to quote, give the exact words, Joyce's prose prepared me to enter psychedelic space. I would say that Joyce is best read while you're stoned, and if you've never had a psychedelic, reading Joyce is the next best equivalent. Yosatani Roshi, with whom I studied Zen briefly, I don't mean to claim I got very far with it, but I studied briefly with Yosatani Roshi. He said once, there's nothing special about Satori. You do it every night in your sleep. Zen is just a trick for doing it while you're awake. Well, you might say Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake are two other tricks for doing it while you're awake.
Doing what?
Achieving full recognition of the difference between the map and the territory, yeah, or between your subjective evaluations, which you can be sure of, they're sincere your own, and the objective reality, which you can never be sure of. All you can know is your own subjective interpretations of objective reality. You can only know the map. You can never fully know the territory. Besides, the territory is changing all the time. Universe is non-simultaneously apprehended.
Now, is Joyce denounced as a terrorist?
Well, as a matter of fact, frequently he was, yes. A lot of the first criticisms of Ulysses were denouncing it for its obscenity and blasphemy, which was just Joyce being naturalistic. This is the way people talk. These are the things people do and so on. And if the fiction has never dared face up to it before, well, if you want realism, I'll give you realism until it collapses on itself, as I said. One recent article defined Joyce as a one-man literary IRA. In a sense, Ulysses destroys English literature because the whole history of English literature is parodied in one part of Ulysses or another. T.S. Eliot said Ulysses demonstrates the futility of all styles. No matter what style you write in, you're not conveying reality, you're conveying a style. And so Joyce does parodies of the Mort d'Arthur, Dickens, Swift. The whole history of English literature is in Ulysses. And every framework changes the way you see the events of that one day in Dublin. You can always find clues as to the objective reality behind all these reality tunnels, but you can never fully define it. For instance, Bloom is carrying on a romantic correspondence with an unknown woman. He signs himself Henry Flower, and it's quite obvious he does not intend to meet this woman ever. He doesn't want to have a sexual affair. He likes to play with the game of pretending he's going to meet her and have an affair, and he's leading her on, but he's too timid to actually do anything as outrageous as commit adultery in Dublin in 1904. His wife is a little ballsier than he is in that respect. But readers a long time assumed that the woman's name, Martha Clifford, was her real name. And then somebody raised the question, if Bloom is using a false name, could she be using a false name too? So there's been a big hunt among the female characters in Ulysses to pick out the most likely suspect to be the one that Bloom is corresponding with. The current leading contender is Nurse Cahill, whom he meets in the maternity hospital, which makes their whole meeting absolutely hilarious. If you think she's the one he's been corresponding, neither one of them knows that the other is the one they've been corresponding. And that's a very typical of the kind of humor that appears throughout Ulysses, mixed in with all the tragedy. Bloom's day is overcast by the funeral in the morning, which reminds him of his father's suicide and of the fact that his son died at only 11 days old. And so although Bloom is a basically cheerful person, there's an undertone of grief that keeps surfacing in his thoughts, and he always cheers up again. And if it isn't Nurse Cahill, it could be Blazes Boylan's secretary, whose first name is Martha, which makes for a very intriguing pattern because, as one Joyce scholar discovered in the Wandering Rocks chapter, when Boylan calls his secretary Martha, if you put it on the map of Dublin, the phone call, you draw the straight line between where she is and where Boylan is, it passes right through the part of Grafton Street where Bloom is standing at that time looking in a department store window. That is so much Joycean that I still suspect it's Boylan's secretary, which has another strange loop because if Boylan is having a real affair with Bloom's wife and Bloom is having a pretend affair with Boylan's secretary, it is another example of Joyce's general study of sexual nuttiness in Ireland. And there are dozens of unsolved problems like that, like the man in the brown Macintosh who shows up at Paddy Dingham's funeral. What makes this particularly intriguing is that Bloom seems to know almost everybody in Dublin. Bloom has had a variety of occupations, and Dublin was still a pretty small town in 1904. Yet he doesn't recognize the man in the brown Macintosh. So the man in the brown Macintosh can't be any of the important characters in the novel, all of whom Bloom knows. And yet the man in the brown Macintosh keeps reappearing. He darts across the street before the royal procession in the Wandering Rocks chapter. He shows up in the Cyclops chapter briefly. And when Bloom arrives at the whorehouse at midnight, the man in the brown Macintosh is just exiting. And you never find out who he is or what his connection with Bloom is or what this series of coincidences mean. And there's been a lot of very ingenious interpretations of that, but I think its major function was to serve Joyce's message that the map is not the territory. He didn't read Koshybsky, but he worked that out for himself. You can never know all about a single day or a single person. The man in the brown Macintosh may be Bloom's lost uncle, or he may have no connection with Bloom whatsoever. There are things you never will find out. That's the way the world seems to me, so I think Ulysses is closer to the world than any other novel before Ulysses.
Is there any indication that Joyce had studied, for example, the physics of the day? And
yeah, in his notes for the Ithaca chapter, it's quite clear that he is trying to write the chapter so that it fits Euclidean, Lobachevskian, and Gaussian geometry. The first sentence of the chapter, what parallel course did Bloom and Stephen follow? And that's from the cabman shelter to Eccles Street. I abbreviated the question. So it turns out that you work your way through the chapter that there are analogies with Euclidean, Lobachevskian, and Riemannian geometry. So in one sense, the two parallels, Bloom and Stephen, never meet. They're like in Euclidean geometry. In another sense, like in Lobachevskian, they meet. In another sense, like Lobachevskian, they get further and further apart. And Joyce did that because he didn't want the reader to be quite sure what the climax of the novel was. We never know the climax of a day. All we know for sure is Bloom is going to get breakfast in bed tomorrow morning. We know that. But we don't know what happens to Stephen after he leaves Bloom's. Bloom invites him to spend the night, and Stephen politely, courteously, but firmly declines and wanders off at 3 a.m. Where does he go? He made up his mind he wasn't going back to the Martello Tower where Buck Mulligan is staying. He's not going to go back to his father's house where the kids are living in miserable poverty because the old man is drinking up all the money. Where is he going to go? We never find out. Stephen just wanders out of the novel and disappears entirely. Maybe someday somebody will find the clue that reveals where Stephen went. I prefer to think he wandered past Finn's hotel and met a housemaid from Galway named Nora.
Joyce's mistress.
Nora Barnacle, yeah.
How much of Ulysses actually revolves around Joyce's mistress?
Well, a lot of people thought Nora Barnacle was the major model for Molly Bloom. When somebody asked Nora about that, she said, surely not, she's fatter than I am. Molly Bloom's language derives a great deal from Nora. Her biography derives from God knows what. Writers will frequently take 20 people they've known and two characters from novels they've liked in the process of creating a new character. You don't even know where your characters come from.
But isn't June 16th an important day in both the novel and in Joyce's life with Nora?
Yes. This is something a lot of Joyce scholars skirt around nervously. They say June 16th was the day Joyce and Nora went for a walk together for the first time. Actually, as Joyce's letters to Nora in 1909, when she was still in Trieste and he went back to Dublin temporarily to open a movie theater which he thought would make him rich, and he got cheated by his partners. June 16th, what actually happened is they walked on Sandy Mount Strand and Joyce made sexual advances and she gave him a hand job. So every year as Bloom's Day gets bigger and bigger and leads to more and more tourist trade and enriches pious Catholic Ireland more and more, they are all celebrating a hand job, whether they know it or not. I think the hand job was so important to Joyce because, based on all the biographical work that's been published so far, it was the first time in his whole life that he had an orgasm with a woman without paying for it. His whole sex life up until then had been entirely with prostitutes. suddenly here was a woman who, out of sheer kindness and love, was willing to give him what he needed, an orgasm, a relief from sexual tension, whatever you want to call it. He fell in love with her, and he stayed in love with her for the rest of his life.
Hadn't he actually had quite a bit of experience in whorehouses?
He started at the age of 14, and he was 22 when he met Nora, so I would say he had experience with quite a few prostitutes.
And June 16th is also the day that's covered in Ulysses?
Yes. He also arranged that those letters to Nora about their sex life, when they were separated, they wrote letters back and forth about their sex life to keep each other erotically aroused until they could meet again. And they wrote to each other about everything they did, everything they fantasized, and so on. And I think Joyce arranged that those letters couldn't be published until 25 years after his death, or 50 years after his death, I forget which. So he knew he was a classic. He never doubted it for a moment. Joyce was absolutely 100% sure he was the most important writer since Shakespeare. And he knew he was creating a whole new literature. He'd be the subject of endless PhD dissertations and so on. And he arranged that it would be long after he and Nora were both dead and gone, and Bloomsday would be established as a national holiday virtually before the Irish found out they were celebrating a hand job.
Who were some of Joyce's associates that were working on other important art during this time?
Well, the major one, as far as I'm concerned, seems to be Ezra Pound. Joyce was living in poverty in Trieste, teaching at the Berlitz School. He had written Dubliners, and nobody would publish it. He had written 1,000 pages of what became the portrait of the artist as a young man. He had made exactly zero, 0 pounds, 0 shillings, 0 pence from his writing in 10 years. Pound was editing an anthology called The Imagists, which were poets who agreed with Pound's ideas about precision of imagery and avoiding abstractions. He knew of any poets who didn't belong to that circle but were writing in more or less the imagist style. And Yeats recommended James Joyce. Pound wrote to Joyce. Joyce sent him a batch of poems. Pound put two of them into the anthology. The two I would have picked, curiously enough. And then Pound wrote back to Joyce and said, send me more poetry. And Joyce wrote back, I'm not writing poetry lately. I'm writing short stories. He sent Pound the Dubliners stories. Pound went off into one of his fits of enthusiasm and didn't rest until he found a publisher for it. It had been rejected by every publisher in England and Ireland and the United Kingdom. Pound found a publisher in New York. And then Joyce started Ulysses, and Pound got that serialized in a magazine called The New Free Woman, later changed its title to The Egotist. It was edited by Harriet Shaw Weaver, who was an anarchist, a feminist, and a Stirnerite egotist and an Emersonian transcendentalist all at once. She started serializing the portrait of the artist, and she was publishing a lot of Pound and T.S. Eliot and Benjamin Tucker, the individualist anarchist who's been a major influence on my thinking. Eventually she decided, when Joyce started Ulysses, that he should not have to undergo the hassles of trying to write such a complicated book while teaching half a day at the Berlitz School. So she sent him a monthly check so that he could quit teaching and devote full time to Ulysses. A few years later, she began supporting him entirely all through the writing of Finnegan's Wake. And to Joyce, none of this made any sense. Why should Ezra Pound, a man he never met, appear out of nowhere like a fairy godmother and work all these miracles to advance his career? But Joyce finally found the explanation. Pound's father was named Homer. I mean, Joyce's mind worked that way. He was always seeing synchronicities and meaningful correspondences, you know.
Why was Pound so intrigued by Joyce?
Well, Pound had a tremendous capacity for enthusiasm for original work. Pound discovered T.S. Eliot and Ernest Hemingway and quite a few others, as well as Joyce. Joyce was one of his major enthusiasms. But T.S. Eliot was a major enthusiasm too. Pound edited The Wasteland at Eliot's suggestion to make it even more modernistic than Eliot's first draft. And he kept writing reviews of Eliot's poetry all over the place, trying to attract more attention to Eliot. Just when Ulysses came out, Pound wrote 5 reviews of that for different magazines, including one in French for a leading French literary magazine. Pound had a lot of generosity and a lot of revolutionary fervor. He wanted to change the structure of Western literature, and everybody seemed to him to be doing something original and important. He devoted tremendous energies to promoting them. Pound also publicized Robert Frost. In the 1930s, in a letter, Pound mentioned a review which was praising Robert Frost as a poet writing in the Native American tradition, as distinguished from Ezra Pound, who's writing as a European, and putting Pound down. And Pound said, "The funny thing was that I knew from the day I started promoting Frost that eventually somebody would use Frost as a club to hit me over the head." Well, next to Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, I think Pound's Cantos has more excitement and information than any other 20th century literary work. Cantos invented modern poetry, you might almost say. Let's say Pound and Eliot and a few others were writing modern poetry before the Cantos. But the Cantos went in so many radical and new directions that poetry has never been the same. You can tell the difference between a pre-Pound poem and a post-Pound poem almost as easily as you can tell the difference between Renaissance music and 19th century music. Pound was a major influence on American and European poetry from the teens of this century on. In the 1930s, he became a hero to a lot of young Japanese poets, and his cult has grown and grown in Japan. There's a whole magazine in Japanese devoted to Pound's studies. And now he's becoming a major influence on Latin American poetry, too.
So is it just his wide-ranging influence that interests you?
No, I was just pointing out that he wanted to make a revolution and he succeeded. What fascinates me about Pound, several things. First of all, I find the Cantos the funniest of all the great epic poems, and in most respects the most beautiful, although parts of it don't look beautiful. Parts of it look pretty dull, actually, until you see how they function in the structure of the whole. And rhythmically, the Cantos are more of a delight to read out loud than just about any poetry in English. And the contents fascinate me. The Cantos seems to me the first multicultural poem. Pound was even more cryptic than Joyce in explaining what he was doing, but he did call it the Tale of the Tribe. And when you look at it, you find the tribe is all of humanity. The poem has as much Chinese history as European or American. It's got African references and ancient Sumerian references. It's an attempt to write a global epic, and it's the first attempt. And I think it's going to be much more important in the 21st century than it has been in the 20th. Because I see the 21st century as the time when East and West will more and more merge. For the intelligentsia of East and West, it'll be a great Rosetta Stone by which the Orient can understand the Occident better and the Occident can understand the Orient better. This is not accurate, but roughly the first third is Occidental, the middle third is Oriental, and the last third is cross-cutting between them to show similarities as well as differences. Like in the closing 30 or so cantos, you frequently get quotes from classical authors in Latin or Greek or Old French or Old English or whatnot with Chinese ideograms in the margin. And this is where Pound wants you to see a connection between an Occidental and an Oriental concept, and he also wants you to see the differences as well as the similarities. I find it about as inexhaustible as Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake. I've been reading the Cantos for 50 years now, and I haven't gotten bored yet. I'm still finding new delights in them.
Do you feel that Pound and Joyce fed each other artistically?
Well, Pound fed Joyce financially for a while. I mean, he helped Joyce get fed. Their influence on each other remains somewhat problematical. I think they were going in different directions, although they were both trying to get away from what they both regarded as the hypocrisy and pomposity of the Victorian period into something nitty-gritty and down-to-earth. But Joyce was much more preoccupied with human psychology, although his interest went far beyond that. But if you can find one center to Joyce, you might say it's the study of guilt and remorse and shame and how it infects human beings, because those are the main topics you notice when you start studying psychology in Ireland. Once you make sex, or once you make 99 out of 100 sex acts into sins, you got a population that everywhere, everybody feels guilty and is afraid they're going to get caught sooner or later. And that's one of Joyce's major themes. And he projects it outward onto the whole of human history, seeing how in different forms it has infected almost all human cultures. Ireland is just one weird special case of that. Pound's interest more and more moved to economics. Pound and Joyce use a lot of the same anthropological sources. And the Cantos begins with Odysseus traveling to the underworld to consult with Tiresias. So there's a slight parallel with the Odyssey, just like there is in Ulysses. There are many parallels and there are many differences. Pound admired everything Joyce did extravagantly up until Finnegan's Wake, which he couldn't stand.
Why?
Well, that's one of those riddles of human life. Pound had a vast appreciation of creative, original work, but Finnegan's Wake was too creative and original in ways that Pound didn't like.
Did he feel Joyce had just departed too far?
Well, when Finnegan's Wake was being serialized in Transition magazine, it was under the working title Work in Progress, and Pound in his letters refers to it as Joyce in Regress. I think Pound looked at a few samples of Finnegan's Wake as they were published, tried to figure out what the hell Joyce was doing, and discovered that a great deal of it was scatological and childish-level excretory and urinary puns. And I don't think Pound deciphered much more than that. He thought Joyce was exploring the murkier areas of the Freudian unconscious, and the hell with that stuff, it's not that important. Finnegan's Wake is... a lot on that level, but it's on every other level too. It's on 1,001 levels. But I think that's the level that you find first, especially if you've read Ulysses and you know that Joyce was pushing towards more and more realism about biological facts that have been under heavy taboo in English-Irish culture for a long time. I also think excretion and urination play a large role in Finnegan's Wake, because Joyce, with all of his elaborations, remained fundamentally a documentary-style artist. And I think Joyce did a lot of studies of the sleeping brain and concluded that all night long, whatever you're dreaming about, one part of your brain is constantly checking whether you have to get up and go to the bathroom or not. I think that's why excretion and urination are so prominent in the brain is constantly checking the bowel and the bladder to see if you got to get up and do something about them being full.
So it was part of the stream of consciousness narrative technique?
Well, it was part of Joyce's documentary approach to literature. There's a great story in Ellman's biography of Joyce when he was the best-known eccentric at University College. He was 18 years old, and he had an article published in the most distinguished literary journal in England. Everybody was astounded. But it was even more astounding that this boy genius was an outspoken atheist, an enemy of the church, and a general rebel. And he was regarded as the eccentric of University College by all the other students, the rebel that the other rebels couldn't understand. And one day he came into a class for which he was not an enrolled student, walked through the back of the room over to the window, took out a notepad, and was busy writing. And finally the Jesuit teacher said, "Mr. Joyce, what are you doing?" And Joyce said, "They're burying an alderman. I'm counting the mourners." Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake are full of that kind of details. when Bloom walks down Grafton Street, Joyce, who was writing in Trieste, wrote to an aunt in Dublin to make sure he got the time right from O'Connell Bridge to Trinity College so that Bloom would not take too long or seem to be running. Behind all the subjective shifting of perspectives, the objective details in Ulysses are astonishingly accurate.
Do we find any conspiracy theory going on in Ulysses?
Well, Joyce used to be considered the most apolitical of artists, but there's been a rebellion against that. I've got three books. Manganiello's Joyce's Politics, which argues that Joyce had a strong sympathy for both Benjamin Tucker's individualist anarchism and Leo Tolstoy's anarcho-pacifism. This is based on articles Joyce wrote in Italian when he was living in Trieste, which hadn't been translated before, and which he does express his political opinions rather frankly. Joyce and the Politics of Desire is a feminist defense of Joyce against feminists who claim he was really a misogynist, and what looks like feminist ideas in his books is really a facade behind it. Joyce fears and hates women, and this one argues that's not true at all. He's one of the greatest feminist artists who ever happened to be born with a willy. Then there's Vincent Chang's Joyce, Race, and Empire, which sees a steady progression in Joyce from Dubliners defending his wake. And Dublin is, it's all about the oppressive effect of British rule on Ireland. In Ulysses, the parallelisms gradually make you see this as part of a general pattern of colonialism all over the world. And in Finnegan's Wake, the multiple language creates a thing where everything refers to the British domination of Ireland, everything refers to every other act of imperialism in world history. So he starts out satirizing British conquest of Ireland, racial stereotypes that were created to justify. This book has some hilarious illustrations from English magazines of the 19th century of what the Irish looked like to the English. They look more like gorillas than human beings in these cuts. I've seen illustrations where Negroes look like that put out by the Ku Klux Klan. This seems to be a very popular thing with racists, to take whatever group you're going to hate and make them look more like other primates than like human beings. And as Cheng points out, this was the literary environment in which Joyce grew up, in which he was classified as subhuman, a sort of gorilla. That's the way the Irish were regarded by the English. This ties in with that extreme view that Joyce was a one-man literary IRA. But Joyce's parodying English racism gets more and more generalized till in Finnegan's Wake he's parodying every type of racism and group prejudice in the world, especially if it has an imperialist motive behind it. Ezra Pound, in one of his reviews, said, in presenting Ireland under English domination, Joyce implicitly shows the entire Occident under the domination of finance capital. That was before Pound coined the word usurocracy, or otherwise he would have said the Western world under the influence of usurocracy. The international bankers, the financiers, he called it finance capitalism in that case.
It's interesting that these two writers, Joyce and Pound, were contemporaneous with each other. What was it about that time in history that seemed to create so many other great artists?
Well, of course, they were contemporary with D.W. Griffith, who revolutionized film, and with Picasso, who revolutionized painting, and Frank Lloyd Wright, who revolutionized architecture. I suppose I would have to say it was the doubling of information. By 1900, information had doubled in 250 years, where previously doublings took millenniums. By 1900, when they were all becoming mature, Picasso, Pound, Joyce, Frank Lloyd Wright, they were all either in their 20s or their late teens. The world was obviously so full of new information that it seemed obvious that we needed new kinds of art to express a new apprehension of the new universe we were in. Specifically, Picasso started his Cubist period after seeing African art in an exhibit put on by the anthropologist Leo Frobenius, who appears frequently in Pound's Cantos because he turned Pound on to African poetry, like he turned Picasso on to African painting. And Levi Brule, the anthropologist, is mentioned by name in Finnegan's Wake, and he's also quoted in the Canto. So is Sir James Fraser, another anthropologist. Well, Van Gogh did a few paintings in Chinese style before he developed his later style, which is semi-Chinese. In a late Van Gogh painting, you have two perspectives usually, at least sometimes three, instead of the one perspective of Da Vinci. But before Van Gogh developed that, he did a couple of paintings in the classic Chinese style, which has no perspective at all except up and down, you know. I saw them in the Van Gogh Museum. What I'm groping my way toward, I suppose, is Andre Malraux's thesis in Museum Without Walls, that the major cause of the mutations in modern art come from anthropology and from, believe it or not, from imperialism. With all the horrors of imperialism, at least it brought back information about people who saw the world in different ways than Western educated people do. And those with the most open and curious minds started experimenting with trying to see the world like the Chinese do or like the Africans do and so on. And that seems to be a large part of the revolution that has occurred in the art of the 20th century.
So in essence, it's a multicultural revolution.
Yeah, well, the Cantos, if it's the tale of the tribe, as Pound says, who is the tribe? The tribe seems to include Chinese, Africans, Americans, Europeans, ancient Greeks, Babylonians. The tribe is the first attempt at a global epic.
And do you think in our own time we're getting closer to this?
Yeah, well, I think the internet is bringing us closer and closer to the point where the tale of the tribe will be available to everybody, whether they read Pound or not. I've got on my email list, I've got people in Germany and Taiwan and Australia and England. And I'm looking forward to getting more people from Africa and Asia on my email list. Well, to quote Ezra Pound again, peace comes of communication. I think the more communication, the better. Or as Norbert Wiener said, to live effectively is to live with adequate information. To me, the Cantos looks more and more like my email, or my email looks more and more like the Cantos. It's miscellaneous, assorted. You can't quite find the order, but there is an order in it. The order is the order of the way human beings relate to the realities around them.
Interestingly, you've written about both Joyce and Pound as, in a sense, prophets of the internet.
Yeah, well, who's generally regarded as the major prophet of the internet? Marshall McLuhan. There are more and more books coming out reinterpreting McLuhan because internet makes a lot of what McLuhan wrote make more sense than it did before internet got as big as it is now. I got a book called Digital McLuhan, which applies his theories to the current state of internet and what we've expected in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, McLuhan always said he got most of his ideas from Joyce. That's no secret. In almost every book, he stops off somewhere to mention James Joyce as the major authority on how media affect us. Well, McLuhan also got a lot from Pound. I first encountered McLuhan in the 1950s in various academic magazines writing essays on Pound's Cantos. And then Pound and McLuhan together formed Square Dollar Press, which was a typical Poundian idea. There's a lot of books that Pound thought were tremendously important that nobody wanted to publish. So Pound got the idea of publishing highlights from these important books in thin volumes that you could sell for a dollar. So even if people didn't get to read the whole book, if they read these selections, they might be so inspired they would spend the money to hunt up a rare book dealer to find the books. So McLuhan and Pound put out Fenelosa's essay on the Chinese written character, which Pound was always trying to get into print and never could find a publisher to print, and a selection of passages from Agassiz illustrating close observation and accurate description, and Pound's translations of the Chung Yung and the Ta Shio of Confucius, and from Alexander Delmar's History of Monetary Systems, I guess chiefly Pound, but McLuhan was co-editor of the series. they selected the worst atrocities committed by bankers throughout history and published it as a history of monetary crimes. And if Pound had the effect he wanted, then Agassiz would be republished in full, and we'd get Alexander Delmas' History of Monetary Systems in full. But anyway, we got the highlights, thanks to the Square Dollar series. So McLuhan was very, very much aware of Pound and Pound's importance. And the technique of the cantos is in many ways closer to Internet than Finnegan's Wake is.
Well, both he and Joyce seem to have taken basically all information available to them and kind of condensed and synthesized it into their own vision.
Yeah, Finnegan's Wake and the cantos are so remarkably different on the surface, but underneath, both of them seem to be trying to include as much of humanity as possible in one book.
What's interesting is to me is that that opportunity is now available to all of us, since we have this giant information source.
That's what I mean about Joyce and Pound being prophets of Internet. Reading Joyce and Pound is much easier now that Internet exists, because every time you're really puzzled, just put it into your search engine and you'll find out, you'll find out something about it. The Internet more and more begins to approximate the minds of Pound and Joyce.
This concludes session 2. Our program continues with session 3.